It doesn't just happen overnight. The perimenopause can occur over a decade. And women can often feel bewildered as to the change in them, into the fact they can't sleep, they get agitated, their memory can fail, they can't concentrate. We talk about changes in the menstrual cycle, and we talk about changes in skin, and we talk about these other physical changes. But actually, women have estrogen receptors in the brain. And so when estrogen becomes depleted, it can affect mental function and psychological symptoms.
That's Dr. Hilary Jones. He's a GP, familiar face on British daytime TV, as well as perhaps less well known as a newbie novelist, weaving much of his medical knowledge into storytelling. This is the Lizelle Wellbeing Show, the podcast helping us all live a better second half of life. I'm Lizelle, and I'm on a bit of a mission to find ways for us all to thrive in later life by investing in our health and our well-being today. Now, I first met Dr. Hilary Jones on the well-worn sofa of daytime television, where he was already the established TV doctor, and I covered the kind of slightly fluffier side of life, my bag being much more about beauty, natural remedies, and even fashion back in those days. And we were often pitched against each other, as my approach was seen as a bit quirkier, a bit less conventional. But what we do share is a common thread of highlighting many of the healthcare issues that we're all facing, regardless of how we choose to treat them. In fact, I was heartened that we recently bumped into each other at an event hosted by the Swiss naturopathic healthcare company, the brand A. Vogel, and they were investigating the clinically proven powers of the plant remedy echinacea when it comes to combating coughs, colds, and the many flu viruses of all kinds that surround us at the moment. So perhaps we are not so far apart at all, and we will be chatting a little bit more on that later. Well, it was at this event that I discovered even more about this familiar face on our TV screens, not knowing that he has just published his second riveting novel, set around the time of the First World War, that naturally draws on his own medical background, as well as his family's own experience during those dreadful times. Hilary's actually written a number of non-fiction medical books over the years, and as I say, he is now embarking on a literary foray into the world he knows well, that of medicine. But set in and around World War I, I am fascinated by his fascination with the story of medicine, past and present, and so I'm keen for this chat to cover both the current state of medical play as well as how we got here.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hilary, it was so good to bump into you again. That was at a recent press event outside, actually, of the TV studios, a place where we first met. Well, it must be well over 20 years ago, I think. You haven't aged, though, I must say.
Well, nor have you. And there's a reason for that.
We do invest in how we look and feel, for sure. But it was really interesting to catch up with you again there. And I know that later in this chat, we will talk more about how you came to be, well, I think possibly the most famous face of TV medicine. And we'll also chat about the current state of GP services, which I know is something very close to your heart. But right now, I'm really interested to hear about how you came into your most recent incarnation and that of a novelist.
Well, it was purely by chance. I was very busy in the Good Morning Britain studio answering incessant questions from Piers Morgan and Susanna Reid about the pandemic.
Oh, well done.
And it was during that time that, almost as an antidote to 24/7 news about COVID-19, that the idea about a novel came to me via somebody called Keir McRae, a literary agent. And there were so many parallels between the frontline workers that were doing so much and were being applauded on people's doorsteps, and the frontline soldiers of the First World War, in which my grandfather fought,
right,
that I thought it would be an interesting exercise to write a book about military and medical history at that time, but also make it into a romance. Mm-hmm. To talk about the parallels between the Spanish flu of 1918, which killed 50 million people or more and came out of the blue, just like this pandemic.
Yeah.
And so the title of Frontline came to me, and in spare moments between talking about COVID-19, I started writing, and I really enjoyed the exercise.
Very therapeutic, actually, to use a different part of your brain and to be, I guess, preoccupied with something else, because, as you say, you were in the thick of it for so long.
Well, just like you, I'd written medical books. I'd written books that were factual. And I found being creative and writing dialogue and bringing stories to life fascinating and challenging and interesting. And I as I researched the stories of the time, I became absolutely entrenched in the developments and the fact that war, by necessity, creates new medical developments. It accelerates them and improves them. So, for example, the thousands, tens of thousands of men lost limbs during the First World War through wounds and infections, and yet prosthetics were in their infancy. And within a short few years, the efficacy of prosthetic limbs improved dramatically as a result of the need to do it.
Yes, through that awful need. It's a bit like, I think, in the Second World War, the advance of cosmetic surgery, plastic surgery, really happened because of all the poor airmen who were shot down and so badly burned.
That's right.
And needed reconstructive surgery. And that kind of triggered all that, didn't it?
Absolutely. And, you know, there were pioneers in their field who tried new techniques, many of which are still used today as the basis of cosmetic surgery and aesthetic practice. And it's fascinating how it develops. And of course, you know, people were thrown in at the deep end. The Second World War also brought about the necessity for the massive production of penicillin, which until 1943, 44 was really not available to the general population. And a fifth of people still died at a young age of infection, because we didn't have antibiotics.
Yeah.
And it wasn't that long ago that was the case.
Your book is really good, I have to say. I shouldn't sound surprised. Thank you. And you've had some high praise indeed. Jeffrey Archer, for example, says of your book, "The Doctor hit the spot and deserves to be read." Is having a voice on the fiction page something that you've always kind of secretly wanted?
Yes. I mean, I was lucky to have had a really good education at Latimer School, where I studied arts A-levels, actually, instead of doing science, as most doctors do to begin with. I was at school with people like the late Mel Smith, who went on to become an author, a playwright and a comedy actor. And we had a fantastic drama department, and I could easily have gone down that route, but I was subsequently encouraged to pursue a career in medicine. But I think I've always used that love of the written word and of drama to want to write a novel. So when the opportunity came along, I grabbed it.
Well, the novels that you've written follow a preeminent medical family. And I know from talking to you kind of off camera, if you like, that your own grandfather was a soldier sent to the Somme, not once, but three times. Did that family history influence your writing?
Oh, very much so. My mother still has a photograph of my grandfather at the foot of her bed in his uniform.
Really?
He fought at the Battle of the Somme. He was wounded three times and was sent back to fight three times after rehabilitation. And we
can
still
you imagine that? I mean, being sent back, knowing what you're going back to, that hell that you came from, having to go back
carnage.
Three times.
And we still have the German bullet that penetrated his neck and obviously from which he survived. So, yeah, it was a particularly poignant story for me, researching that and the conditions in the trenches and the terrible attrition that took so many hundreds of thousands of lives. And it did occur to me that soldiers who had survived that onslaught then were subjected to the ravages of the Spanish flu, which 200,000 people in the UK alone died of the Spanish flu. And interestingly, Liz, it was young, healthy people who succumbed, perhaps more so than young and elderly, that we would normally see affected by things like flu viruses. And we think it was because they had such an overwhelming immune reaction that basically their lungs flooded with fluid. Of course, we had no antibiotics to treat secondary infection, and we didn't fully understand transmission of viruses like that at the time. So it was a steep learning curve.
And also, I imagine that everybody who returned from that literal hell on earth will have been so traumatised. And we know now the effect of things like trauma on our immune system and lowering it. So they were adversely affected in any case. And actually, you've raised before issues such as PTSD. And isn't it staggering to hear that back in the day when your book is set, even the very word of shell shock was actually banned?
It was. It was banned by the British Army till 1916. There was a fear that should soldiers be given an excuse for turning their back on the battlefield, that others would follow suit and they needed as many soldiers in the trenches as they could muster. So people who were suffering clearly from shell shock, whose mind just wasn't there, and who were wandering about confused and dazed, some of them would have been shot for desertion.
Many of them tragic.
Had sentences commuted, but some didn't. And one of the themes in my book is the theme of a soldier who had won awards for bravery in other fields of warfare and fought in France and in Flanders and would have suffered shell shock. And my character in the book is shot for desertion because he can't defend himself. And it was a summary execution. And this almost certainly happened. So even today, PTSD is still poorly understood. There are a lot of servicemen who are suffering from it and probably not supported as well as they should be. So it's an enduring theme, which hopefully I can pursue in the next book.
Very interesting. So this is a saga, is it, that's going to run and run?
Yeah, I hope it'll be a saga, a bit like a combination of Foyle's War and Downton.
Brilliant, yes.
And Brideshead. And the book between the two wars is about the massive social change, the suffragette movement. There's the IRA. There's so much going on, but also you've got a small elite who are spending money like it's going out of fashion, despite the poverty elsewhere. There are still parallels today with all of that.
Yes. Oh, my goodness. And actually thinking about veterans and trauma therapy, have you worked with more recent veterans and is trauma therapy changing? Are we more aware of it and more able to help, do you think?
Yes, we are. We do understand more clearly that a huge amount of support is required, not just socially, but psychologically. If you've lived with the loss of the traumatic loss of friends, colleagues, comrades, if you've been under constant shell fire in fear of your life, not being able to sleep, it certainly takes its toll. And those people need ongoing help to deal with aggression, which can apparently come from nowhere, anxiety, depression. And of course, we see a lot of self-harm and suicide in people who've subjected to these kind of traumas. And there's plenty of trauma in the world today. So we still need greater understanding in mental health generally, but especially for war veterans who've been through that sort of experience.
One of the things that I've been looking at more closely recently, which I find completely fascinating, I'd be interested to hear your take on it, is the role of psychedelics. And there's a New York investigative journalist called Michael Pollan who's done a brilliant series, I think, on Netflix called How to Change Your Mind. And he's looking at the therapeutic things like, or the therapeutic use of things like LSD MDMA, psilocybin. I mean, it's extraordinary how these things could have the capacity to unlock trauma. And I have read of studies being done with veterans on this very thing.
Yeah, well, we repurpose drugs all the time. So drugs that we've used for one thing can sometimes be very effective for another. I think we can all remember that thalidomide was a very dirty word because it caused so much damage in terms of limb development in offspring to mothers who took thalidomide as an anti-sickness drug. And then we discovered subsequently that it had these disastrous side effects. But now we use thalidomide as an anti-cancer treatment.
Really?
For the same reason that it stopped limbs developing, it stops cancer growing.
Isn't that fascinating?
So we can repurpose drugs in that way. And we look at that all the time. You know, could this drug be useful for that? And again, you know, fascinating research that I found for my book, where, for example, people were given, deliberately given malaria to treat certain conditions, to treat people who were having reactions to, say, disease with syphilis and that sort of thing. So giving people a fever to treat psychological disease and psychiatric disease was quite common back in the day. And it was described by Hippocrates centuries ago. So
yeah.
We can still, you know, play on those ancient ancient knowledge to help people today to some extent.
Extraordinary. And do you think that having that medical element to your life is going to influence the stories that you write? Is there always going to be a sort of underlying medical theme to your writing?
I think so. They always say, don't they, that you should write fiction about what you know about, you know, what is second nature to you. And, you know, I still find the drama of medicine captivating. So
and
you know,
ever-changing too.
Absolutely. I mean, I've been in so many situations during my career where things take your breath away and you never forget them. Things that are dramatic, things that are shocking, things that are incredible and life-altering. And I find that quite interesting to write about. And when I write about it, it usually comes with two reactions to readers. And that is, oh, my goodness, that was very dramatic and quite shocking. So somebody said, I could have done with a bit less of that. Other people say, that was amazing. I could do with a bit more of that.
Mm.
And I suppose it depends whether you're somebody who is drawn towards intervention and drama, whether you're one of those people that, you know, find somebody collapsed and immediately goes to help, or someone who stands back and lets somebody else do it.
Well, one of the parts of your life I feel I maybe know a bit less about is right back actually at the start of your medical career, when you started practicing in quite obscure places, like the most isolated inhabited island in the world. Tell us about that.
Yes, I'd done a stint at my training hospital, the Royal Free Hospital. I'd been there for 6-7 years doing my training and working in A&E and intensive care. And I was still relatively young. And I thought it would be nice to have some adventure before I embarked on a academic career in medicine in a city or in the UK. So I saw an advert in the British Medical Journal for a single-handed doctor on the island of Tristan da Cunha. And I didn't actually
where
know
is
where
that?
Tristan da Cunha was.
I'm glad you said that because I have no idea where it is.
Well, I looked at it at the map and eventually found it. It's as you say, it's the most isolated inhabited island in the world, right in the middle of the South Atlantic Ocean, halfway between South Africa and Uruguay. And it's a British dependency with a population of about 300 people.
Really?
Yeah. And at the
do
time,
they have a pub and a shop or not?
They do. They do. And everything is brought by boat. And the boat used to come 3 times a year. So
no.
It was a fishing trawler, which took about 7 or 8 of us to the island. It moored offshore and little boats came out and picked us up and picked up all the supplies that they would need for the next 4 months.
Must have been like Christmas, supplies. You know, every time the boat was seen, I imagine people flocked to the shore to see what goodies it was bringing.
Exactly right. And of course, the boat would sometimes bring a virus with it. Someone would have a cold and everyone would get it because they had no immunity. But it was a fascinating time. And it was the only time in my life where whatever happened, I would have to deal with. So if somebody was going to deliver a baby, if somebody had an appendicitis, if somebody had pneumonia or a head wound, it would be me dealing with it, me doing x-rays, me doing the surgery, and being the nurse and the doctor at the same time. A huge challenge, and I would never tackle it today.
Knowing what you know, you just wouldn't do it.
It was the impetuosity and the arrogance of youth that encouraged me to do it, but it was a wonderful experience, and I'm happy to report that nobody died whilst I was there.
How long were you there?
I was there a year in the end, because they asked me to stay on for the next boat and then the next boat, because they were finding it difficult to recruit anybody.
Yeah.
But eventually I said, look, my wife is pregnant. I don't want to deliver my own baby. I will be leaving.
Yeah. How extraordinary. But what, as you say, what an amazing baptism by fire. I mean, going into the medical world with that kind of experience, I guess you almost feel that you're prepared for anything having done that.
It was an amazing experience. And after that, I kind of fell in love with islands because it was so unique. And I went to Shetland after that, which took me out of my love of islands to some extent. But even that was interesting as well.
So from islands to TV studios, that's a bit of a stretch. How did that happen?
Well, I'd been in general practice by that time for about 10 years. And general practice is fascinating and interesting, but also there's a large element of bread and butter, and that's what you'll be doing for the rest of your life. And I just wanted another challenge, and I wanted to use some creativity and drama. So I wrote to, and also I was very interested in public health, messaging people to say, you know, this is how it should be. I was never in favour of very academic medicine and talking in jargon and medical terminology, and I always like to put myself in the patient's shoes, and I would explain things in plain English, and people respected that and liked that. So I wrote to TVM at the time and said, give us a job. You know, you're using a lot of academic professors who use jargon. What about a bog standard GP like me who could be there on a regular basis and people could get to know me? And that's exactly what the MD at the time was thinking. And I went to meet them. And they said, we'll try you out for 2 weeks and see how you go.
And how many years ago was that?
Yeah, that was 33 years ago.
Was it really? Mm. Well, I want to come back and talk more about your medical practice, your TV work, and also, interestingly, I think, about where we are going with modern medicine and the current medical system. Let's do that after the break, so don't go away.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Mm-hmm.
Well, welcome back. And Hilary, I'd love to talk of the moment now. We've talked historically, obviously, with your novel writing and has some fascinating insights into medical history. Where are we at right now with the current state of our UK GP services, and what can we do as patients to help?
Well, I'm fully aware that so many people are saying that they're finding it extremely difficult to get an appointment with their GP. They're frustrated, they're angry. And of course, when they don't get that ability to see their GP quickly and there's a problem, they tend to go to accident and emergency. Now, there are various problems here. This is not good for the NHS. It's not good for GPs and it's not good for patients. When patients go to A&E inappropriately, the problem doesn't get sorted out. An urgent issue might be looked at, but usually the advice is to go home and to put things in train of motion to get it sorted appropriately. So A&E gets bunged up, and that's one of the reasons ambulances are stuck outside accident and emergency departments. So a lot of people are going there when they should be seen by a GP. A GP is fully qualified. They're capable of doing minor operations. They're capable of running asthma clinics, diabetic clinics. They're capable of so many things. And GPs used to be regarded as the gatekeeper of the NHS. But if you can't see your GP, that's breaking down. And it's a worry. When I was first a GP, I ran a personal list. I would know my patients. They would know me. And we didn't have to duplicate the consultation every time because I knew medication they were on. I knew what their medical history was. It was right in front of me. And we would talk, and it would be done effectively and quickly. Now, if you don't see the same doctor twice, you're always starting from the beginning. You have to duplicate everything. And communication is a real problem in the NHS. It can be marvellous when it works well, but it can be immensely frustrating when it doesn't. And recently I had to report on the case of a baby who stopped breathing and the ambulance didn't arrive for 30 minutes. After which it was too late to save the baby. And this was no fault of the paramedics, who would have been devastated that they didn't get there earlier.
But
if there aren't the resources, if we don't have enough doctors and demand is still rising, we've got these problems. So we must recruit more people passionate about medicine and a nursing career than we're currently doing.
That is going to take time, isn't it? Because even if we achieve that and we do get more youngsters going into medical school, the training is long, and so, you know, we can be easily looking at a decade or more before we even begin to dial it up a bit.
That's right. The time between entering medical school and practicing as a full-time GP is about 10 years. So that training is absolutely vital. But we also have to look at retention after graduation. It's completely right that half of our graduates are female. We need women in medicine. In fact, we have more women in medicine than men, in general practice anyway. So that's vital. But of course, many of them will have families and need to go part-time. So we lose time with patients that way. Also, in some medical schools, a high proportion of people go on, never practice medicine. They go and work in the city, or they go and do something
really?
Else. Or they go overseas. And, you know, we need to be a little bit more possessive about the graduates we train at enormous cost to the taxpayer. So that at least they do something like a short service commission as they do in the services. So
we're going to get
10 years work out of them.
Yeah. Well, this is a conversation that unfortunately I think is going to run, but it's really interesting to get a bit of an insight and some background into that. And actually, talking about background, moving on, you are the doctor credited with diagnosing that our mutual friend, Lorraine Kelly's anxiety symptoms were not, in fact, potentially a mental health issue, but due to the menopause. So how did that come about? Did you spot it with her?
Well, of course, I've known Lorraine for as long as I've known you, Liz. Mm. And you know, we're on the same show, and when we talk backstage, as it were. And, you know, I was aware that she had symptoms. And, you know, I sort of gently approached the subject of the menopause, which is insidious. It creeps up on people even as early as the age of 40. It doesn't just happen overnight. It's the perimenopause can occur over a decade with gradual changes, and therefore it's not attributed to cessation of periods or a sudden stop in anything. But gradually, the physical symptoms and the psychological symptoms can combine. And women can often feel, I mean, I've known this in general practice, women can often feel bewildered as to the change in them, into the fact they can't sleep, they get agitated, their memory can fail, they can't concentrate. We talk about changes in the menstrual cycle, and we talk about changes in skin, and we talk about these other physical changes. But actually, women have estrogen receptors in the brain. And so when estrogen becomes depleted, it can affect mental function and psychological symptoms. And, you know, so I just had this gentle conversation with Lorraine and suggested we do this and that and do a little bit of investigation. And now she would never, I think, do without a hormone replacement therapy.
No,
and
she
talks publicly
vocal.
And openly about it. And is a great advocate.
And it's great that you can do that, and that is the power of the media, isn't it? That you know, we can step in, hopefully, and bring about some positive change. What do you make, then, of all the recent rise in awareness about hormonal health and menopause? Presumably, you're there kind of championing it alongside us all.
Oh, yeah, I embrace it. I think empowerment is so important for individuals, for finding out as much as you can about these things. I mean, I'm still a bit surprised that we haven't got there yet, because I've been talking about the menopause for so long.
Yeah.
And one has to keep banging that drum, because I think it's still a bit of a stigma for some people. It's still misunderstood. Some people say, oh, no, it's natural. You don't need these drugs to get through it. But actually,
but it's not a drug. I don't regard hormones, my own natural hormones, as a drug. It's just like insulin is a natural hormone for a diabetic. They're not, you know, sort of, I don't know, taken to task for replacing what they need. No. Why should we be with estrogen?
Quite right. It is, I mean, 100 years ago, women didn't live long past 50. So the menopause was never really a great problem in the past, looking back in history. But of course, women are living twice as long now, and they want quality of life as well as quantity of life. So it makes absolute sense to replace what is a natural hormone, as we would do for a patient with Parkinson's who runs out of dopamine, or a patient with an underactive thyroid who runs out of thyroid hormone. And I'm quite sure that if men were depleted of testosterone, they would demand testosterone on prescription.
Oh, be way back there. Actually, do you know what? You wouldn't even need a prescription. You'd just be able to walk into your pharmacy and pick it up off the shelf, or your pharmacist, like you know, you can do with Viagra. It's just, I think, let's not get started on the healthcare gender inequality, because sure, there is massive. Maybe next time. But you know, it's so great to hear you talk about that, and to have you as part of our Meno Warrior campaign, and know that you're alongside us on this. Actually, interesting, talking about Dr. Train. How much training in hormones or actual menopause care did you receive back in the day?
Very little. We obviously did our stint in gynecology and obstetrics, but it's very physically orientated. So it is, you know, the function of the uterus, the function of the ovaries, about safe delivery. So the psychological aspects of the menopause and that field was very much neglected. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, we have this continuous professional development in medicine, to keep updated. And yet, I think it's absolutely true that one of the reasons that so many GPs are still fairly lacking in knowledge about the menopause is we're just inundated with the workload. You know, if we're doing 70, 80 hours a week in incessant demands on diagnosis and prescriptions and treatment, how much time is left to read up on new developments? I mean, it does occur, and I think that there is a much better knowledge about the menopause and hormones and endocrinology generally. But a GP can't be an expert in everything. He's a jack of all trades.
Yeah.
And a specialist is the opposite. You know what a specialist is, Liz?
What?
A specialist is someone who knows more and more about less and less until they know everything about nothing. Whereas a GP is jack of all trades and knows a little bit about everything, or should be.
Yes. There is actually a very good menopause training course accredited to the NHS, run by a platform called 14 Fish, which I know does a lot of refresher courses for NHS medics, and it's called Confidence in Menopause, and that actually has been very helpful I know the Menopause Charity actually were instrumental in getting that across, something like 14,000 GP surgeries.
Yes.
And updating doctors and practice nurses. So that is a good thing. How do you stay on top of changing approaches in healthcare, I mean hormonal health and other things? Do you still practice as a GP?
Yes, I do. I'm part-time now, which is actually a lovely way to practice medicine because you can give people the time they need. If you're full-time, you're really given about 7 minutes per patient, which is absolutely inadequate.
It's hardly enough to say hello, is it really?
Exactly. And if you need to examine a patient and explain the treatment and the options of treatment, it's an impossible ask. And you know, it's one of the reasons why GPs are unhappy at the moment, because we want to practice safely. We want to talk to the patient as a whole, not just talk about their one issue. And it's important that we find the time. And as a part-time doctor, I can give people the time they want to get to the heart of the problem, to explain, to reassure, to investigate. And that's how medicine should be. And in Europe, France and Germany, for example, there are probably twice as many doctors per head of population than we have. So I believe they don't earn as much, but that's not the point. The point is that, you know, to practice medicine with that job satisfaction, we need time with patients. That's what we want. And I think if there is a strike ballot amongst paramedics, nurses and doctors about their conditions, it won't be about pay. It'll be about patient safety. We want to practice good medicine and we want to do it safely.
Is it helpful then, if you have got such a short allotted appointment time, to come in armed with information from Dr. Google and to try and kind of fast track the diagnosis? What's your reaction as a GP? Is there a major eye roll or is that actually a helpful thing?
What I find helpful is a patient to come in with a written list of their symptoms and a diary. So, for example, with the menopause, a menstrual diary is really helpful. If a patient comes in and says, my periods are irregular, the first question I want to know is, well, how irregular? Are they heavy? Are they light? Are they painful? Are they every week? Are they every 3 weeks, 3 months? If you come in with a diary, it's all there. And you can see at a glance what the pattern of the menstrual cycle is. And that's time-saving and very helpful. On the other hand, if people have looked at the Daily Mail...
Oh, don't go there.
For example.
Yeah.
other newspapers are available, of course.
Yeah.
Or Google. You know, you could have gone right down the wrong track. You know, the first thing people look at when they look at some websites is if they've got headaches, brain tumour.
Oh, gosh.
Well, brain tumour should be right down at the bottom of the list.
Yeah.
You know, up there should be tension, headache, migraine, dehydration,
right.
Stress. So I think Google has a place, but I think that writing down details of your symptoms and what you've noticed, when, how often, duration, severity, type of pain, that's much more important for the doctor to learn about.
And actually, just before we leave the subject of menopause, there is a brilliant free menopause app actually called Balance Menopause. And it has exactly that. It has a symptom tracker.
That's
and
good.
So many prompts that you can then fill in precisely so that you can fast track that conversation with a GP.
Useful to know.
So moving on, I know that you spent some time specialising also in ophthalmic health, and I do want to touch on eye care because I think it's one of those things that becomes particularly important as we make our way through midlife. What changes here do we need to be aware of?
Oh, I think that there's plenty we can do to protect our eyes. One of the most common conditions, for example, is dry eye syndrome, which is something that people don't know a lot about, but when we look at a computer, we blink 6 times less per minute than we do ordinarily. And it's no wonder then, with air conditioning and central heating, that people complain of dry, gritty lids and sore eyes. It's important to lubricate the tear film. So we produce tears, but tears evaporate on the surface of our eye without the tear film, which is an oily layer produced by the little glands on our eyelids. And these get blocked, and we can warm them up with a hot eye compress, and we can massage the glands.
I've done that actually. My optician, sorry to interrupt you, my optician said I had blepharitis.
Yeah.
and told me that I had to put hot compresses on my eyelids. That's a thing, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely, because these oil glands get blocked. I was horrified when my eyes were sore a little while ago, and I went along to a clinic where they took photographs of the oil glands in my lids, and I could see how inflamed and blocked they were.
Ooh.
And what they did with the little clamp on my eyelids, they warmed up these glands, liquefied the oil and expressed the oil to unblock the glands.
Really?
And I've never looked back. I've looked after my eyelids since then, and it's made a huge difference to the soreness that I used to get. That's all gone. And I use a bit of lubricating eye drop now and again just to replenish the tear film. I mean, that's one of the things that I think we all need to be aware of. And then, of course, sunlight, just as it damages the skin that you know everything about, you know, can lead to cataracts as well. So those regular eye checkups are really important. Cataracts, glaucoma, of course, an asymptomatic silent disease, which can gradually damage the peripheral vision. So we end up with tunnel vision. Eye checks are really important. And, you know, even though we're in an economic recession and we're trying to cut back, we shouldn't cut back on dental appointments and ear checkups and eye checkups. That's important.
Are you a fan of laser eye surgery?
Yes, I am. I couldn't get on with contact lenses when I reached that age where everything has to be, you know, read at a distance.
Exactly. Nothing wrong with my eyes. My arms are just not long enough.
Yeah, that's right. I remember that. But I tell you, I remember once I was on an outside broadcast early one morning in the winter, and I had to try and find the address of an old lady who was going to talk to us about some loneliness and isolation in the winter. I was trying to find, before satellite navigation, I was trying to find her address in my A to Z.
Oh,
and I realised in the dim light of my car I couldn't read the street names, and I had to phone for guidance as to how to get there. So I realised I had to do something, but I couldn't get on with contact lenses, and I couldn't get on with bifocals. So I had what they call laser blended vision, where they leave your dominant eye for distance and your non-dominant eye they laser for reading, and you end up with two different depths of field in each eye, but your brain then accommodates the two fields of vision. So without glasses, you can look into the distance and you can read as well. And
that
suited me very well.
That's really clever, isn't it? I mean, I'm also a big fan of laser eye surgery, having had that in the past. And I just think that our eyes are so precious. You know, it really is worth looking at the best ways to take care of them.
You must go to the right people. That's important.
You're absolutely right. Spot on. And actually talking about kind of taking care of ourselves as we age, I don't mind sharing with you because we know each other well, and obviously there's nobody else listening. You know, I do have a big birthday next year. I'm going to be 60. You're going to be 70. You absolutely do not look it. Have you felt any particular pressure being on TV to look a certain way? I mean, I know that a lot of, you know, aging female colleagues do feel pressure. Do you think that there's a disparity between men and women on TV? And do you feel anything yourself?
There is a disparity. I think women are unfairly discriminated against as they get older, and jobs might disappear. Perhaps that's more likely. Personally, I have never let TV fame go to my head. I've always been very level-headed. I see myself as a doctor who just happens to be on TV delivering public health messages. And whilst, you know, getting a bit of attention is very pleasant, usually.
Sometimes, yeah.
I don't work too hard at it. I mean, I spend very little time in the makeup room. In fact, I do my own since the pandemic.
Do you? What do you do? I mean, you just had to wear a bit of powder and sort of base, do you, just to say, so you don't look washed out? Mascara?
Yeah, a little bit.
Do you?
So a bit of anti-shine, a bit of powder, a bit of mascara for the missing third of one eyebrow after a bike accident.
Oh, no.
And that's about it. And I'm of an age where I really don't mind if I've refused a hair transplant a few years ago. Yeah, I wasn't.
And your hair is now pretty white, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
But it's good. It looks funky. I have to say, you know, you've got quite a choppy haircut.
It is what it is. But for me, how I feel is much more important than how other people see me. And I mean, exercise has always been a very important thing for me, and it's kept me, I think it's kept me on my toes, and it's kept me as young as I can be, and it'll always be part of my life.
What other daily kind of non-negotiables do you have to keep yourself physically or perhaps even mentally vibrant?
I've always been an optimist, so I have this amazing capacity to see everything as an opportunity rather than as a complaint.
I
think that, you know, we all have to face difficulties and problems, but I always seem to say, well, that's happened, but on the other hand, there's this. And I do think that generally, as we face the challenges in society coming our way in the next decade, we must be more grateful for the things we have and demand less. And we must expect that sometimes have to get used to a standard of living that wasn't quite as good as it was, and be grateful for the wonderful things that we do have at our fingertips, and think about other people who don't.
Gratitude is the most fantastically life-enhancing attribute, isn't it? If we can weave a bit more gratitude into our lives.
And a bit more kindness, a little less anger. I've always found that being kind to people is wonderfully uplifting. It actually gives one a sense of feeling, you know, that's something good that's happened today. And people are generally very grateful for it.
Yeah, giving to others gives back to ourselves, definitely. What about some of the kind of biohacking things that I'm super interested in personally, things like intermittent fasting, you know, time-restricted eating? Do you embrace any of that?
Well, I intermittent fasting was something that sort of occurred completely by accident with me. So, you know, when one's distracted from the hunger of boredom through work, we don't eat those unnecessary calories. So when I'm working early in the morning, for example, I won't have breakfast, and I'm quite happy to be busy and work through till later in the day before I've eaten. And that often means that I've intermittently fasted since the night before without even trying.
Gosh, so you're getting that health benefit and you're resting your gut microbes, you know, unconsciously.
Automatically.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it is the case when, you know, the weekend arrives or I'm on holiday that actually you think, well, a breakfast would be nice, but I don't think about it the rest of the time. And then combined with exercise, and I know people are amazed and they say, oh, how can you get through to lunchtime without having anything to eat? But it's not even something I think about.
No,
a cup
really...
of tea, fine. And that's enough.
Yeah. Absolutely. What about things like cold water swimming? Are you tempted, you know, Wim Hof, all of that? Are we going to see you in an ice bath anytime soon?
Well, I have done. I did the Great North Swim a few years ago.
Did you?
Windermere. And I think
that's
that was cold. About 8 degrees. And I can see why people will get addicted to that. Unfortunately, I don't live very near a stretch of water.
You can have a cold shower. That's what I do.
Oh, I can have a cold
mornings.
Shower. I could certainly have a cold shower. And I like sort of... if it's raining, it doesn't stop me going out for a walk with the dog. So I can get down and dirty with the earth and do a bit of, you know, heavy gardening. I don't do fussy gardening, but the heavy stuff, I'm quite happy to go and chop up logs and things like that in any kind of weather. And I do think, you know, getting down and dirty with nature is quite important. For me, that lovely smell of the earth after it's rained, petrichor.
Oh, yes.
It's just beautiful. Can't beat it.
That's interesting because I have to say, you and I haven't always seen eye to eye, perhaps over some of the more, say, alternative therapies and practices gaining popularity. But is it fair to say that you dismiss all of these always in favour of more allopathic treatment, or are there some things that we can agree on from the natural world that are beneficial?
Oh, gosh, yes. I mean,
aromatherapy
is
love
wonderful.
That.
You know, I think that can be a great a source of relaxation. Massage is underrated. Occasionally, I mean, when I did Dancing on Ice, I was introduced to a sports masseur who is just incredible. And if I'm feeling that my joints and my muscles are a little bit knotted up, I'll give her a call and, you know, I can get off that couch feeling like $1 million. So I think massage is underrated. I think certain supplements are useful at certain times of life. And I think there are many. I mean, there are alternative therapies that I don't particularly agree with and support, such as iridology, such as Reflexology. I like having my feet rubbed.
Oh, but... reflexology, come on. No. That is my favourite thing.
Is it? But I love having my feet rubbed, but I'm not
sure. Oh, it's more than that.
That having a thumb massaging a point in my foot is going to alter my bowel.
Well, do you know, I remember my very, very first reflexology treatment, I mean, 30, 40 years ago, thinking this is just a foot massage. And it was only when the reflexologist was sort of moving her thumb up and down a particular part of my foot, and she's saying, your vertebrae, was it your seventh vertebrae on the left? Was there an issue there? And that was literally about 2 months before where I'd really hurt my back. And I thought, that is extraordinary. I'd not said anything. You know, you pick that up. Mm. And I actually do have reflexology probably a couple of times a month and will pick up little things. You know, sometimes, I remember actually recently the reflexologist said, is your throat okay? And I said, yeah, it's absolutely fine. She said, oh, that's funny. I just, you know, can detect a little bit of imbalance or something. And 24 hours later, I had a sore throat. Now, whether she brought it on, I hope not, or whether it was kind of brewing there.
Oh, well, maybe I should try it again.
Okay.
Open my mind.
Well, there we go. And actually, you and I did reconnect with each other at an event where we were looking at the benefits of echinacea, which was also very interesting, wasn't it?
Yes.
To actually look at that as, you know, potentially help for antiviral and colds and flus.
Yes.
And that whole kind of Swiss-German botanical healthcare history, which I think, you know, perhaps we could learn something a little bit more from, maybe.
Of course. I mean, we so many of the pharmaceutical medicines are produced from plants. It absolutely makes sense to look at other things. And echinacea has been talked about for years as a herbal remedy for the prevention of viral infections, colds. And there is a growing body of evidence of randomized controlled trials that supports the use of echinacea on an intermittent basis to boost the immune system and prevent colds and coughs. We're likely to see more of them this winter because with all the precautions we've been taking about COVID-19, we've reduced our immunity. We've been protected from colds and coughs, but they're going to be coming back. So if you want to take extra zinc, if you want to take a bit of echinacea and boost your immune system by healthy living, then no harm done, certainly.
Excellent. Love it. Love it. Love it. And in the future, is writing going to take over from your TV and media work? Are you ever going to be allowed to retire and put your feet up? Do you even want to?
Well, I do keep myself busy in my time off. And, you know, I love doing all sorts of things. But I think if I can do them all in tandem for a little while longer, I'll enjoy that. I certainly enjoy writing. I certainly enjoy the TV. And I enjoy seeing patients still because, you know, that's my roots, if you like. And, you know, when someone's worried and anxious and they can't get the help they need, just sitting down with them and saying, come on, what's on your mind? Let's investigate and explain to them where they are. I mean, that's immensely rewarding. So if I can combine all these things together, variety is the spice of life. And whilst I'm enjoying it, I'll carry on.
Dr. Hilary Jones, a pleasure as always to chat, and very best of luck with the new novel, Eye of the Storm, out now. It's a good read. Well, if you missed last week's episode, that was with the psychotherapist Lucy Beresford, and she gave me a lot to think about when it comes to dating after divorce. And you can go back and listen to that whenever you like. And if you continue to scroll back, you will find some other brilliant chats that we've had recently. Everything from workplace confidence in midlife to the therapeutic practice of tapping. I wonder what Hilary would make of that. Well, join me back here next week. Until then, do join us for more conversations on social media at Lizelle Me and at Lizelle Wellbeing. All of us here always love reading your reviews on whatever podcast platform you like listening on to. Well, until the next time we chat, go well. Bye-bye. The Lizelle Wellbeing Show is presented by me, Lizelle, and is produced by Anushka Tate for Fresh Air Production, with additional production support from Ellie Smith.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with five different spray patterns. so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.